The growing inequality in the United States is attributed to a number of causes. To Professor Ray Madoff, the U.S. tax code is a primary driver of inequality for reasons that are not particularly well understood. She lays out those reasons in a surprisingly readable new book, given that it's about tax codes, The Second Estate, How the Tax Code Made an American Aristocracy. We're very lucky to be joined by her this morning. Good morning, Professor Madoff.
Good morning. Nice to be here with all of you. By the way, just as a side, it's Madoff, not related.
I can't say I blame you for making that clarification.
Yeah.
Okay, so Professor Madoff, go ahead. What motivated you to write the book, and how long did it take to do the research?
Okay. So what motivated me to write the work is that I have been working in the field for a long time now. I'm a professor of tax law, estate planning, wills and trusts, things like that. I was a tax lawyer before that. And over the course of my work and academic experience, I have come to see that our tax system is not what it appears to be. And there's a lot of reasons for the public to be confused by the tax system. And the problem is that they are confused into thinking that the wealthy Americans are paying more taxes than in fact they are. And so I was very driven by this idea of explaining to the public what is actually going on in our tax system and what we can do to make it better.
So let's dig into that a little bit. Look, the American tax system is perceived as being, and it is ostensibly progressive, but you argue that in the context of the modern economy, it really is actually quite regressive. Why do you say that?
Yeah. So I think it's important to start back in the beginning just to sort of set the framework, which is that our current tax system was enacted in the wake of the Gilded Era, early in the 20th century, a time when there was massive wealth inequality. The taxes that were there were tariffs, and tariffs basically imposed the greatest burdens on consumers and farmers and other people who didn't have much money. And the modern tax system was designed to make our system more fair by imposing more burdens on those who had a greater capacity to pay. And this was done by having an income tax, the modern income tax, which was enacted in 1913. And it originally only applied to the top 5% of earners. But even after it was expanded to apply to almost all Americans, it had this progressive rate structure so that those who earned more paid a greater percentage of their income than those who paid less. So that was clearly geared towards getting people who had greater capacity to pay. On top of that, in 1916, we enacted an estate tax, a tax that currently operates as a flat 40% tax, and it applies to all transfers during life and at death. And together, these taxes were designed to impose significant burdens on the wealthiest Americans. However, what has happened over the past 40 years is that changes have occurred that have resulted in a situation where our current tax system, instead of imposing its greatest burdens on the richest Americans, it essentially gives them a free pass. For the richest Americans, taxes are essentially optional, and many of our richest Americans are opting out of the system.
So now, why is the often repeated argument that the top 1% pay 40% of the income taxes, while the bottom 40% pay no income tax, at all true, but it's actually misleading? I mean, why is that constantly being discussed?
So I call that the statistic that saved the rich from taxes. And we see this appear in a lot of places. I used to see it just in the Wall Street Journal, but surprisingly, or perhaps not surprisingly, it's now showing up in the editorial pages of the Washington Post, perhaps related to the fact that Jeff Bezos is its current owner. And The Economist recently had an article called The Robin Hood State, suggesting a similar statistic that the rich are already paying all the taxes. The reason that this is so misleading is that when it talks about let's just focus on the first part, which is the top 1% pay 40% of the income taxes. What they're saying here in reality, is the top 1% of income earners pay 40% of the taxes. Those with lots and lots of taxable income. High-paid lawyers, doctors, finance people, people with very big salaries who have a lot of income are paying a lot of taxes, and those with the most income are paying the lion's share of the taxes. The problem is that when you look over at our wealthiest Americans, they are not necessarily the people with the most income. And that's because the wealthiest Americans follow what I call the tax avoidance playbook. They are able to essentially avoid taxable income and therefore avoid taxes. Indeed, a rich American is just as likely to be in the 40% of Americans that pay no taxes as they are in the top 1% of taxpayers. And that's because the richest Americans, do you want me to take a pause here, Bess?
No.
Okay.
No. I'm going to ask you where I can get this playbook.
Yes, you can get it in the second estate of the Tax Code Made in American Aristocracy, available in bookstores everywhere.
There you go.
The tax avoidance playbook is that, it was just for most Americans, anybody who relies on a job or they work for themselves, right? Anyone who works for money, it is very difficult to avoid taxes. We have a comprehensive system that imposes heavy taxes on wage earners. And we do so because we have income taxes imposed at the highest rates, up to 37%. And on top of that, we have payroll taxes that are very burdensome, and they are imposed taxes up to 15.3%. And so, and these taxes, payroll taxes, apply from the very first dollar earned. So when we say that 40% of Americans don't pay any income taxes, many of them have very significant payroll taxes, and we shouldn't forget that. However, when it comes to the richest Americans, they are able to avoid both income taxes and payroll taxes by avoiding traditional income. First, they avoid salaries. So if we look at the salaries of many of our richest Americans, we'd be surprised by how modest they are. So Warren Buffett, you know, he complained that he paid lower taxes than his secretary, but part of it was because he took a very modest salary for the greatest stock investor of all time. He got a salary and bonus combined of just $100,000. Right? That's pretty modest for somebody who you would think would be, his services would be highly valued. Jeff Bezos regularly takes a salary of $82,000, an amount that was low enough to enable him to claim the child care tax credit, which he did. Mark Zuckerberg, Larry Ellison, Elon Musk is a little bit of a separate example, but many of these people take salaries. They're just dollar a year guys. They just take very small salaries. And so they are, they don't have salaries and they therefore avoid taxable income and avoid payroll taxes. Now, of course, they have enormous wealth, but their enormous wealth is different because that enormous wealth has come about through a growth in the value of their stock. And they have become, you know, people with hundreds of billions of dollars that is held in appreciated stock. Under our tax system, this stock is only taxed if they sell the property. But they don't need to sell the property in order to use the value of it. They can simply borrow against the stock and live off of the borrowings, and that borrowing occurs entirely tax-free.
Yeah, no taxes on the loans.
None at all. And so, in this way, you know, they have acquired enormous wealth that enables them to exert a lot of power in the world, and yet they don't necessarily pay any taxes because if they don't sell, they don't pay taxes.
And I guess there's another layer on that, Professor, which is that even if they do sell, the tax rate they pay is substantially lower. What's the justification for that?
Yeah. So that's a really good point. So the second point is that the rate of that is only is a maximum of 20% plus an additional, for some people, there's an additional net investment income tax of 3.8%. So, but it's in any event, under 24%, whereas wage income is up to 37% plus an additional up to 15.3%. So it is a much more favorable rate. And when you ask the justifications for it, that's a really good question. It's one of these things where there are many justifications, but none on their own seems particularly sufficient for having this. So, for example, one of the justifications are that we need to lure in more money for investment. And the only way we can do so is if we provide beneficial tax rates. Otherwise, people won't invest their money. But, you know, when you think about it, wouldn't that same thing apply to people working for a living? And do we really need investment capital more than we need labor? And of course, today, there was a very interesting op-ed about this by Nick Rohaten recently that talked about how, in fact, we are awash in capital. We've got nothing but enormous capital really looking for places to be invested. So there's not really a problem with getting sufficient capital or getting people to invest. And so I think that this preference for investment assets is really not warranted in the world that we live in. One of the examples I talk about in my book is an Uber driver versus an Uber investor, and each person acquires $100,000. Their tax treatment is entirely different. And do we really want to be saying that Uber workers should be carrying all the burdens and Uber investors should somehow be given a free pass?
That is a fun mathematical thing that you lay out in the book. You know, there was another element to this that I hadn't really focused on until I read it in the book, which is the implications of stock buybacks, something that was illegal until relatively recently.
Yes. It's very interesting. And to think about it, so let's think about our companies, right? Our very, very profitable companies and how they share their profits with their shareholders. Prior to 1982, there was only one way that a company, a profitable company, could share profits with its shareholders, and that was by issuing dividends. And when they issued dividends, for much of the 20th century, those dividends were subject to tax at the highest ordinary income rates, the same rates that applied to wages. So what that meant was that somebody who owned a lot of stock got a lot of dividends and paid a lot of taxes, right? And more than in the 1970s, more than 70% of the corporate profits were distributed through dividends and were taxed at the highest rates. Beginning in 1982, there became a new way for companies to share profits with shareholders. And that was to buy back their own shares on the stock market. And the effect of that was that for those people that chose to sell, they would sell their stock. But for the people who retained the stock would go up in value because there were fewer shareholders owning the same business. And what this means is that for those people who didn't sell, they could have tax-free growth in their assets rather than taxable dividends. The reason this was particularly bad for the country at large is that many of the people that choose to sell are those that would be otherwise exempt from taxes, either because they are pension funds or nonprofits or other exempt organizations, or because the owner of the shares had offsetting losses. And so they didn't mind having the capital gains because they could offset it with their existing losses. And so instead of having a system where corporate profits were much more likely to be taxed at the shareholder level, we now have a system where corporate profits are unlikely to be taxed at the shareholder level. And add to that the fact that corporations themselves are increasingly unlikely to be taxed because of the lower tax rates on corporations and their ability to shift their income offshore. We have a system where another source of wealth is not really being subject to tax in the American system as effectively as it should be.
So let's talk a little bit about the buy, borrow, die strategy, which I think integrates into this rather nicely. How does it work and where do I sign up?
Yes, exactly. So first of all, to the extent you're getting a salary or getting paid for your work, you've already made a critical error, right? Because as we said, for people who work for a living, it is very difficult to offset that income. And one thing I just want to note here before talking about buy, borrow, die is that the reason that high earners cannot offset their income is because of tax reform that closed that loophole. Prior to 1986, lots of high income earners were offsetting their income by using tax shelters. Mm-hmm. But in 1986, that tax law ended tax shelters for high earners. And the reason it's important to be mindful of that is that there's often a lot of despair about the capacity for our tax system to close loopholes on powerful entities. But we've done it in the past and we can do it again. So if that's a diversion, but now on to the one of the ways that people avoid taxes. So let's say that I am a very smart investor and I invest in Apple stock. And my Apple stock, I bought it for hardly anything and now it's worth $10 million. During my life, I don't want to sell that $10 million because I don't want to pay capital gains, even though I'd get a preferential rate. And so what I do is I simply borrow against that $10 million and I use that borrowing to support whatever it is I want to do. Maybe I want to buy a vacation house or maybe I want to, you know, spend it in some other way. So no taxes on that $10 million during my life. Then if I die and pass that stock on to my kids, they are treated as if they had purchased the stock for its fair market value. And if they sell it for $10 million, they have no taxes on that gain. That's because of something called step up in basis, right? That wipes away gains on transfers of property passed at death. It's a tremendous giveaway, one of the many giveaways that we have for inherited wealth. The other thing is, what about my kids? Won't they pay taxes? And the answer is no, because under our income tax system, property received by gifts, inheritances, at death, or through life insurance is not only not taxed, but you don't even have to report it. You don't have to tell anybody. And yet, if you and I were to engage in some type of barter exchange, we would both be required to report to the federal government the value of the services we received. But if we are handed $10 million, nope, nobody cares.
So why isn't the effectiveness of that strategy substantially limited by the estate tax? Doesn't the sort of stepped up basis, the value at death, isn't that part of the calculation of the estate and therefore subject to tax?
Right. So the justification for it was this idea that the estate tax took care of this problem, right? And so the estate tax used to be imposed at very high rates, 70%, with very low exemptions. In the 1980s, it was about $600,000 was the exemption. It was increased to $1 million. The idea was that the estate tax would take care of this. And so that's why we don't have to worry about the income tax. However, over the past 40 years, a number of things have happened to the estate tax. One is that the exemption amount has grown to be much, much larger. So now it's not $600,000 or $1 million. It's $15 million per person and $30 million per couple. So already just the sheer amount that's exempted is quite significant, $30 million before somebody is subject to tax, before anybody is subject to tax on that wealth. But there is an even bigger problem with our estate tax system. And that is that many of your listeners might remember how the estate tax was subject to a pretty powerful campaign where, beginning in the early 1990s, where George W. Bush and others started to refer to the estate tax, not as the estate tax, but as the immoral death tax, a double tax that hurt family farms and businesses, an immoral tax, right? It was seen as just a horrible thing. And this campaign was tremendously effective. The goal of the campaign was to get the estate tax abolished altogether. And the estate tax was only formally abolished for 1 year. It was abolished for 1 year in 2010, but just for 1 year. And then presumably it came back. However, what was even a greater impact was that this campaign against the estate tax was so effective that Congress, regardless of which party controlled Congress, it failed to do its job to close any loopholes in the estate tax. And this will make a tax utterly unsustainable, right? If you think about how taxes work, the way they're supposed to work is there's kind of a dance between taxpayers and their advisors and Congress, right? Congress passes rules imposing taxes. Taxpayers and their attorneys try to find their ways around the rules. Congress and the IRS is supposed to close those loopholes. Taxpayers come back, they try to find more loopholes, right? And unfortunately, what's happened is that the campaign against the estate tax was so effective that while taxpayers and their advisors continued their work of finding loopholes, Congress and the IRS stopped closing loopholes. And so, although they had enacted significant reforms in 1986 with the generation skipping transfer tax and 1990 with special valuation rules, since 1990, Congress has not enacted a single provision closing a loophole in the estate and gift tax world. And as a result, these loopholes have flourished, making the tax essentially optional. And there's two examples of this that I think really shows how utterly ineffective our estate tax is. One of them is when you look at the amount of money that is raised by the estate tax. The richest 1% of Americans currently own a massive amount of wealth, $55 trillion. Okay, this is at a time when the total federal revenue is $5 trillion. The richest 1% own $55 trillion. Yet, how much did they owe in estate and gift tax? $28 billion in 2025. $28 billion. That is nothing. That is far less than Elon Musk earns and loses in a single day. And the reason for that is because of all of the loopholes. The second reason we know that the estate tax has become utterly ineffective is that in 2025, when Republicans controlled everything and enacted the tax bill that reflected all of their greatest dreams, they didn't even ask to repeal the estate tax. They left it in there. That was supposedly their number one issue for 36 years. But when the time came and they could easily have enacted repeal, they didn't. And I think it's because they know that the existence of the estate tax provides more cover than burden for the wealthiest Americans.
Yeah. Now, if we could back up for just a moment with the buy, borrow, die.
Sure.
Who are they borrowing? So you got $10 million of Apple stock. Who are you borrowing from? Are you borrowing from your online, Fidelity, Scottrade, E-Trade, like that?
Well, no. I mean, when you're talking about our wealthiest Americans, right? They're borrowing from private lenders who give them very good deals.
Gotcha.
So,
and the stock is the collateral.
And they use the stock as the collateral, and they have so much stock that these loans are extremely well collateralized. It's not just like some regular person who has $10 million of of stock, and that's all they have. They might be able to borrow against their stock to buy some things, but that's not the type of thing that's really raising the significant problem for society.
You have to give credit to Frank Luntz and the Republicans for the way they turned they turned away from the concept of an inheritance tax, which sounds like something that's fair to the American people. You know, you should pay taxes if you're going to get a big inheritance, to a death tax. It was absolutely brilliant. And, you know, you talk in the book about the year 2010, I believe, which was the one year that there was a holiday, where there were lots of murmurings about suspicious deaths in the end of 2010 in order to minimize estate taxes. I will confess that I delivered a eulogy in 2010 and commented upon how the deceased would have been overjoyed at his choice of the year of death because it exempted him from his estate tax.
Anyway. Estate planners, not known for their humor, had some jokes about, like, gifts to give your parents in that year, warm chicken salad, hang gliding lessons. There was time for lots of merriment. It was called also the Throw Mama from the Train year, making reference to the old movie. The thing is about the estate tax and about Frank Luntz is that the estate tax, it was very clever, but the estate tax did have an Achilles heel that made it particularly vulnerable to this charge. And that is that the estate tax is imposed on donors, right? The person who died, the person who's giving away the property. And for many people, that person might very well have paid significant taxes during their life, right? If you think about a wage earner subject to high income taxes, high payroll taxes, they could very well have paid significant taxes during their life. And now they're being subject, the same person seems like they're being subject to an additional tax just because of the additional misfortune of having died, right? You can see how the script almost writes itself. Proponents of the estate tax try to switch the focus on the recipient by calling it the Paris Hilton tax. That didn't really go too well because the problem was it didn't look like it was imposed on beneficiaries. It looked like it was imposed on donors. And there's a lot of confusion by the public about whether beneficiaries do or do not pay taxes. And this kind of ignorance about how we treat things on the recipient side, combined with the potential for double taxation on the donor side, I think made the public even more receptive to the idea that this tax is unfair somehow.
I want to talk about the charitable deduction. Can you explain how the charitable deduction effectively means that the government is simply subsidizing the charitable priorities of individual donors?
Yes. So we have a lot of benefits. Let me step back for a second and say that the United States is different from a lot of other countries because in the United States, we look to charities, nonprofit organizations, to do a lot of things that in other countries are done by government. So, you know, providing health care or museums, education, right? All of these institutions we do through our nonprofit system, and other countries might fund them much more through direct government expenditure, right? Government hospitals, government universities, and things like that. When our income tax was enacted and when tax rates went up, the universities went to Congress and said, we're going to have a problem here. Because rich people are going to be asked to pay a lot of taxes to support government, and they're going to stop supporting universities. And therefore, we should have some deduction that allows people to give offset their income taxes and instead give money to universities. And so they said you can give up to 15% of your income and get a deduction to give money to universities, right? So it was understood that there would be a trade-off basically between paying taxes and giving to universities and other charities. Okay, So in our country, nonprofits play a very important role. Charitable giving plays a very important role. And the way that we support this is not through direct government spending, but instead by creating this matching grant program where if people make a donation, the government lets them reduce their taxes to a certain extent. And that is functionally the same as if the government is paying part of our donation. So we call it a tax subsidy, right? Our donation is being subsidized by the federal government.
Does that make sense?
Yep. Yeah, absolutely. And that also leads right into donor advised funds.
But before we get to donor advised funds, I want to say the problem is from a policy point of view. So the idea of it, it has, if you look at it just writ large, it's a great thing, right? Because we live in a very diverse country and we all have different ideas about how to make the world a better place. And this function of lots of charities with tax benefits for charitable giving enables us all to pursue our vision of the good. And we get a government, the government's chipping in relative to all of our, right? So if I think Irish step dancing is the best thing in the whole world, it's going to save the world, then, you know, I can make a donation to preserve it. I get a matching grant from the federal government, whatever the cost. We can all pursue the good. And in that way, it's kind of a pretty cool system. The problem is the way that it operates is in a way that's very disturbing. And that's because 90% of Americans get essentially no tax benefits for their charitable giving. And that's because they have high income, but they take the they don't itemize their deductions. And that means they can only deduct, under the new bill, they can deduct up to $1,000 of their donation, but nothing else. And so we have very little benefits for 90% of, payroll taxes cannot be offset by charitable donations, right? So regular working people get hardly any tax benefits for their charitable giving. However, when we go over to the other side, to our person who has enormous stock growth in the value of their stock, right, where they would be subject to capital gains and estate and gift taxes, it's an entirely different story. And that's because they are able to fully avoid capital gains and estate and gift taxes on their donations to an unlimited extent. And together, those tax benefits are worth about 60% of the value of the donation. And then you add on top of it, they might also be getting an income tax benefit that could raise that whole benefit to like 74%, right? They can get lots and lots of tax benefits for their charitable giving. Well, 90% of Americans get no tax benefits for their charitable giving. So this seems kind of really unfair. And what we're doing is we are hyper-subsidizing the donations of the richest people, not just because they give more dollars, but because they get more benefits for every dollar that they give. And that's really problematic. The other problem is caused by where the money gives. Most Americans give money to the local food bank or churches or hospitals or to cure disease or all sorts of different things, typical charities that we think of, homeless shelters. However, the wealthy tend to give to charitable intermediaries, either their own private foundations or a donor advised fund. A donor advised fund is basically operates in some ways like a charitable foundation. In both of these, the donor gets money, gets tax benefits up front for funding this charitable intermediary. And the idea is that the charitable intermediary is going to spend money for charitable good over time. The problem is, under our current rules, there is no time frame under which this money must ever be spent. And that's because donor advised funds have no payout rule, right? You get all the tax benefits up front with no requirement for the money to come out. And while private foundations have a 5% payout rule on the books, that rule can be satisfied by simply giving to a donor advised fund, where the donor continues to control the funds with no requirements for these funds to ever be distributed. So we're giving enormous tax benefits for charitable giving, with no assurance that these funds will ever be made available for charity.
And if they have their own charity, then they can take it from their foundation into their donor advised fund and then fund their own charity.
Well, their own charity would be a private foundation, because that's a private foundation is a charity that is only funded by a small number of people. So
can they make a closed loop from the foundation into the donor advised fund?
Yes.
Back to the foundation and just constantly.
Not back to the foundation.
Okay.
But they can keep it in the donor advised fund, and they don't need to get it back in the foundation. The donor advised fund is just totally available to them, distribute as they want.
Professor, before we go, you spent a lot of time and thought on this. You obviously have some ideas about how things could be made better. Can you tell us what you would do if you took control of Congress and were able to pass the legislation that would make it all better?
Absolutely. I think there's four steps that would make the country and the tax system a lot fairer. If you realize that the problem is that we are heavily taxing work, but we don't tax investments and inheritances, the answer is to bring investments and inheritances back into the tax system. We need to get rid of the estate tax, right, which purports to do this, but does it very poorly, and I would suggest doesn't do it at all, and instead reform our income tax system to make sure it covers investments and inheritances. What I would suggest is that for those investment gains that go up in value, we adopt the rule that they have in Canada. It was recommended by both Barack Obama and Richard Nixon, which is the rule that whenever somebody transfers property, either during life or at death, they tally the gains. Once you give up ownership, that's when you tally the gains. So you don't have to sell it to tally the gains. You just simply have to, you no longer own it, you tally the gains before you give it away. And that way we ensure that investment gains are taxed to the person who earned them. The next thing we need to do is on the inheritance side, we need to recognize that right now we have a huge preference for inherited wealth that is imposing significant burdens on all the rest of us who are have to both pay higher taxes and also have to carry the costs of an enormous national debt that's growing due to insufficient taxes. So we have to figure out to what extent do we want to allow a preference for inheritances. I don't think any American thinks that there should be an unlimited preference for inherited wealth when all other sources of wealth is taxed so heavily. So I say we decide how much we think each person should be able to inherit tax-free. Maybe it would be $1 million, maybe $2 million. And then after that, they should be subject to the income tax system just like any other source of income. We should also equalize the rates, because I think there really is no justification for these lower rates for investments over labor income. And finally, we should reform our charitable tax rules to make sure that it's not just tax benefits for the wealthy, but is actually benefits for society at large.
All right.
Okay. We've spent a few minutes talking with Professor Ray Madoff about her new book, The Second Estate: How the Tax Code Made an American Aristocracy. Professor Madoff, thanks for spending so much time with us this morning.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed talking to you.
We will be right back after this.